All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Yeah, let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah 45, if you would. Isaiah 45. I'm going to start about 30 seconds early because last Wednesday we had such good discussion, I didn't get a chance to get through all my material. And so we're going to have one of those classes where I'm going to ask you to hold off on the comments until about halfway through. We're going to have to finish up chapter 45, and I also want to get through the end of chapter 46. I'm hoping that's going to take me about just about halfway through the class. Then we'll stop, take some comments, questions, and we're also going to have to get done with chapter 47 this morning as well. Now, Isaiah is prophesying 100 years in advance that Babylon will be able to go to Jerusalem. They're going to be able to burn down God's temple and take the people captive to Babylon. And when this happens, will God not be discredited? I mean, why shouldn't all who witness this just go ahead and worship Babylon and its gods? That's where these two next sections come in. We're going to look at this section where God's going to prove that the idols cannot redeem like he can redeem Israel. And we're also going to finally look at judgment specifically against Babylon. And that is the reason why God is raising up Cyrus to deliver, to knock out these guys right here. And so let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah 45 and verse 18. In contrast to the idols, the end of chapter 45 here is going to show how God works in four distinct ways throughout history: creation, revelation, salvation, and affirmation. First of all, he works through creation. Look in verse 18. For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it and did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no one else. In other words, he created, he formed, he made, and established. And he didn't do all this without meaning. He did this specifically for human habitation. And so he can deliver Israel from anything. He can deliver them from the idols, and he will not fail them. I know this sounds repetitious at this point. Haven't we seen language like this over and over again in chapters 40 through 48? Well, the point of this is to pound it into our awareness. That's why we have this repetition. So God works through creation. In verse 19, he works through revelation. It says, I have not spoken in secret in some dark land. I did not say to the offspring of Jacob, seek me in a waste place. I, the Lord, speak righteousness, declaring things that are upright. And so he goes from creating to initiating the conversation. And it's very plain conversation. You know, the idol's message came through supposed magic and superstition. God's word was made plain. It was made open and accessible to all who wanted it. Okay? God also works through salvation. Look in verse 20. He says, gather yourselves and come. Draw near together, you fugitives of the nations. They have no knowledge, who carry about their wooden idol and pray to a God who cannot save. Now, this is reminiscent of chapter 41, in which the Gentiles' response to Cyrus's coming invasion was to make more idols. But this time, as you see, the Gentiles are labeled there in verse 20 as fugitives, as if they're escaping some invasion. And as they're escaping, they're carrying their idols that cannot carry themselves. Just think about that. They pray to these idols because of their helplessness, but these idols can't even help themselves because they're having to be carried. And so once again, they are challenged to bring forth evidence of their predictive ability. In verse 21, he says, declare and set forth your case. Indeed, let them consult together. Who has announced this from old? Who has long since declared? Is it not I, the Lord, and there is no other God besides me, a righteous God and a Savior? There is none except me. Isaiah has already prophesied the gathering of the Gentiles to salvation. But if you think about it, God had said this long before in Genesis chapter 12, had he not? But the fact that God describes these things in advance puts him so far above the man-made idols. And as time goes on and these prophecies continue to be fulfilled and those fulfilled prophecies stack up, the heathen would finally start to recognize this. And this is one of the reasons why we see so many God-fearing prophecies proselytes by the time of the New Testament. And so the invitation to the Gentile is to turn to him, not the idols. Verse 22, turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. Israel's salvation would not just be seen by Israel, it would be seen by the world. The whole world will be invited to be saved. The idol gods failed the Gentiles. Israel's God will not fail them. Okay, so we've seen creation, we've seen revelation, we've seen salvation, and now we see God's work through affirmation. And these are going to be some very familiar verses to us here. Isaiah 45, 23. I have sworn by myself, the Lord has gone forth from my mouth in righteousness and will not turn back, that to me every knee will bow, every tongue will swear allegiance. They will say of me, only in the Lord are righteousness and strength. Men will come to him, and all who are angry at him will be put to shame. In the Lord, all the offspring of Israel will be justified and will glory. Familiar verses right there in verse 23, right? Quoted in Philippians 2 about Jesus. The phrase in verse 23 is interesting. That phrase, I have sworn by myself, that is word for word what God told Abraham in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 16 after Abraham offered Isaac. And it's to stress that his word will not fail. And what is promised? What is promised is that every knee will bow. Philippians 2, right? Every knee will bow. All the earth on judgment day, whether judged or saved, will recognize him as the one true God. And verse 24 tells us what that confessing tongue will acknowledge. The world will finally be convinced of God's power and his absolute faithfulness and reliance in word and in action. And unless there is godly sorrow and shame over sin in which we own up to our foolish ways, there can never be that repentance. Repentance that will save us. And then in contrast, verse 25 tells us true Israel's birthright will be confirmed, not so that they can be arrogant because they're going to bow down with the rest of the world, but their boast will be in the Lord. And all this comes about because of Cyrus. And so Israel shouldn't be questioning God's judgment over sending Cyrus. They should be thankful. All right, that's everything I intended to cover on Wednesday and didn't get a chance to. I want to go ahead and jump right through chapter 46. As I said at the very beginning, let's hold our comments till we get to the end of chapter 46. Hopefully that'll just take us about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'll take some comments and questions before we get into chapter 47. Now, as we get into chapter 46, we're going to continue this theme of how the idols cannot redeem. God, as a preacher, if we can call him that, and I think we can, he doesn't beat around the bush, does he? He calls names, right? And beginning in chapter 46, he specifically names some of the parties that are one day going to bow down to him. Look in verse 1 and 2. It says, Bel has bowed down, Nebo stoops over, their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle, the things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beasts. They stooped over, they bowed down together, they could not rescue the burden, but have gone themselves into captivity. Now, that word Bel, that's one of the main Babylonian idols. It's shorthand for Bel Marduk. It's actually a cognate with Baal, who we're very familiar with. But this was Babylon's chief god of their pantheon. Nebo was considered Bel's son, and he was called the god of learning and writing. Now, both of those appear in names that we're very familiar with in the book of Daniel, right? Bel appears in the name Belshazzar. Nebo appears in the name Nebuchadnezzar. They always named themselves after these gods. But every year during Babylon's New Year's party, Nebo was brought together with Bel, and some of their priests would write in these things called the Tablets of Destiny, which were the fates that were decreed by the gods for the coming year. But you can be sure that whatever they wrote in their Tablets of Destiny that was going to happen when Cyrus came could not have been predicted. They would have never known the fate that they were about to undergo. In fact, the ones who wrote about the city's fate when Cyrus came would be victims of its fate. These images that were once paraded around with just great pomp and reverence around the city, what's happening to them now? They're being consigned to ox carts for evacuation. I mean, think about that. They're such a nuisance to carry that they're assigned to beasts. They are so helpless, they sink down to the knees, just as Dagon did in 1 Samuel chapter 5, when after they had conquered the Israelites and taken the ark captive, if you remember that. Because as we just read, every knee will bow down, and these idols will do it long before judgment day. In contrast, notice in verse 3 and 4 how God has carried Israel from the wound. Verse 3 says, "Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, you who have been born by me from birth and have been carried from the womb, even to your old age I will be the same, and even to your graying years I will bear you. I have done it, and I will carry you, and I will bear you, and I will deliver you." So those beasts obviously would not have wanted to bear the weight of those idols any more than we would, but God, He wants to bear and carry our weights, doesn't He? You know, even a child reaches a point where he doesn't need to be carried in anymore. And as we get older, our children may eventually have to carry us, right? But we never outgrow our dependence on God, whether in old age or infancy. So do you see the contrast here between what they had to do to these idols and what God has always done for them and has always done for us? And if I had to choose, what am I going to put all my time and attention to? Something that's going to be a nuisance and a burden for me to carry, or someone who has just carried me my entire life? That's the idea here. Look in verse 5. Remember the song, "Nothing Compares" by Prince? You weren't expecting that this morning, were you? Y'all look sleepy, and I had to do something to wake you up. You were watching football or something last night. But you remember that song, right, by Prince? Now you're not going to be able to get it out of your mind. Well, that's basically what we see here in verse 5. "To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we would be alike?" You know, the idea here is that not only is no one God's equal, there's not anyone that's even broadly similar to Him. Jehovah is utterly and completely unique. That's the case even if you take these idols and if you wrap them up in the most valuable material that you can get your hands on. Verse 6, "Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale hire a goldsmith and he makes it into a god. They bow down, indeed they worship it." So much money and attention given to the production and care of worthless idols. That word "indeed" right there contains that Hebrew participle of irony that I brought up before. It would sound something like, "You bow, and boy, did you ever bring yourselves down to worship." He's stressing the folly of it. Verse 7, "They lift it upon the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place and it stands there. It does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from his distress." That phrase, "though one may cry," again, same Hebrew participle of irony. It is to show the absolute absurdity to even think that one can pray for deliverance to something that stands staring lifelessly into space that needs picking up, it needs carried, it needs setting down. You know, the only time that we ever see an idol ever move in Scripture is in 1 Samuel chapter 5, isn't it? When Dagon fell down to the ark. All an idol is good for is to be a burden on our money, on our time, our intellect, and on our human dignity. All right, and so verse 8 begins a summary now. And as we get to Isaiah 46, verse 8, it's really starting to begin a summary of really chapters 40 through this point right here. It's a final appeal for Israel to accept the Lord's will no matter how unprecedented. Look in verse 8 and 9. "Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me." Isaiah's appeal here is to reflect on God's historical record of bearing them and caring for them. That phrase there in verse 8, recall it to mind, is a very similar phrase in the Septuagint to the Greek that we find in the King James Version of 1 Corinthians 16:13. That phrase, quit ye like men, or if you've got the New American Standard, act like men. In other words, it's as if what he's saying in recall it to mind there is he's trying to say, don't act like vacillating weaklings who are overcome by misfortune. Remember, that's how they were feeling in chapter 40 in verse 27. He says, don't act like that. Act like strong people who are able to respond and to reason accordingly. Will they believe God, or will they choose to revel in their terrible misfortunes? I think that's the idea here. In verse 10 and 11, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. They may not like it, but as we see here, once again, God does not play down the fact that he's going to send Cyrus. And if Judah becomes too firmly grounded in national independence, they're never going to accept Cyrus as part of God's plan. And if they won't accept Cyrus as part of God's plan, how are they going to accept a Messiah who is not according to their hopes either? And then the chapter concludes in this way in verses 12 and 13. Listen to me, you stubborn-minded, hence the picture, who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay, and I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. You see, they are far from God's righteousness, but will they stay that way, clinging to their own ways, or will they bow to his? That word salvation in verse 13 is an interesting word. It actually comes from the root word to mean make wide. Think about that, to make wide. It's denoting freedom from that which restricts. So do you see how they're restricting themselves by going their own way? They've heard and they've heard and they've heard, and yet they haven't heard. They've seen, and yet they've not seen, but because they're blind. And everything always seems far off to people who are blind, right? So God himself must come and he must save. They didn't deserve God's mercy, but God brought salvation anyway. Because of who they are? No, because of who he is. That's the point. All right, thank you for indulging me to get that far before we took questions. Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
It's interesting to me that you have these stubborn-minded people and you have God, and yet these are two points. The stubborn-minded people are far from righteousness, but God is not far off from them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So he's there, right there near, but they're far away from the righteousness that he wants them to have. So it's kind of a contrast there to be near and far at the same time.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mention that, because, I mean, typically when we talk about our sin, we talk about how it creates this, like, chasm between us and God, and really, that's true, but there's another side to that as well. He's a lot closer than we realize. It kind of reminds me of the paradox of the cross. You know, did God forsake Jesus, or did he not? Well, both. That's part of the paradox of the cross, and it's interesting how our sin creates its own paradoxes in our relationship with God, does it not? Yeah, good point. Yeah, Keturah? I think it means that because they were not able to be righteous in and of themselves, he was having to bring it for them so that they would be righteous by virtue of his character. I think that's the idea. And probably, you know, thinking about it, probably too, the idea that everything he is doing here, though it would have seemed so odd to Israel, it's still the right thing, despite the fact that it does feel odd. It probably felt odd to them that they were sitting there in captivity. We're God's people and we're sitting here in captivity. No, that was right, because they were being punished. They needed that time. It probably seemed odd that God was sending a pagan Gentile named Cyrus to rescue them. Why not Moses, you know, sending a pagan Gentile? No, that was right. That's God bringing his righteousness, despite how they feel. So there's probably, we could probably talk about that all day, actually. It's pretty substantial comment there. Yeah.
There's the messianic element of that too. When we're not able to bring our righteousness to God, he had to bring it, you know, to us through the cross, through Christ.
Yeah, no matter how hard we try, right? Yeah. And we're going to see in chapter, I think it's chapter 63, our righteousness are like filthy rags to God. Yeah, Ron.
Just the steadiness of God to be the same every day. And that, you know, we wake up every morning somewhat different, a change, and hopefully for the good. But we don't have to guess where God's going to be today or tomorrow or where he was yesterday. He is He is so faithful and strong and consistent and constant.
Yeah.
If we would let him be in our lives.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes my wife doesn't know what she's going to get from me, depending on whether I've had my morning coffee. But, you know, God's character is pretty much the same day to day, is it not?
And he keeps describing that over and over in these verses.
Yeah, Bruce?
You know, it's always puzzling, and Isaiah makes the contrast between God and all these false gods, these idols of wood and stone. And this Bel Marduk that the Babylonians worshipped. It's puzzled me that these people, maybe not all of them, but at least the ruling, the kings, I would give them some credit for being intelligent. But year after year and decade after decade, these idols were there. Could they not see that these idols were just as Isaiah described them? They did nothing. And I guess that carries down to today. We look at maybe not these kinds of idols, but we look at some ways of thought and say, can people not see what this alternative is, and then what God offers us through his son? And it is a puzzle to me that they don't see that.
Yeah, I suppose maybe the puzzle is solved when we think about it in terms of our day. Money is an idol to us, right? And we don't realize how worthless that idol is until it's taken away from us. I mean, while we're all sitting here, you know, in our air-conditioned building and our nice clothes and going home to our nice homes and all that, it seems like, you know, our idols are doing a lot for us, doesn't it? Until God comes and takes them away. So maybe that's kind of the key here. In fact, that's what he's going to sort of allude to there in chapter 47, is how Babylon just had it made for so long until God brought Cyrus to them and made them suffer things they had never experienced before.
There's still idols all over the world, handmade.
Yeah.
Different societies and cultures.
That's right.
So we haven't finished our charge.
Yeah. You go to, you know, as smart as some of these Asian countries are, I mean, they are even more technologically advanced than we are. You go and you find idols there in their countries a lot more than you will here. Yeah. Chuck?
Yeah. I think it's right. When God gave the Ten Commandments, one of the first things was, don't make any engraven images. It's not just that they didn't want him, some idol over here. They didn't want him trying to make an engraven image of him.
Because
then he would be no different than the other gods, right? They just standing there. He didn't want that because he is different. He is in charge, and he's forever.
Yeah. You can't reduce God down to man-made substance, that's for sure. Not divinity, yeah. All right, any other quick comments before we move right into chapter 47? All right, chapter 47. Isaiah is now going to move from the idols to the main thing that he had in mind for Cyrus to do, and that is to conquer Babylon. Remember what I said at the beginning, when Babylon came and conquered Jerusalem, that might cause some people to discredit God a little bit and think, wow, you know, Babylonian gods, they must be a lot stronger than Jehovah, because, you know, they were able to come in here and to burn the temple, tear down the walls, just destroy the whole city. Maybe we ought to go and worship the Babylonian gods and not Jehovah. But what we're going to see here in chapter 47 is that was all part of God's plan, and now Babylon is going to face their humiliation just like Israel did, except this is going to be a humiliation from which they would not recover from. In verse 1, very strong language here, by the way, so just prepare yourself. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. So what we're going to see all throughout this chapter is Babylon being represented as a beautiful, arrogant woman who before this occasion had only known luxury, had never experienced life's harshness. But what we're going to see in chapter 47 is God is saying all that's over now. She's now going to be forced to trade her pretensions for slavery. She's going to be humbled to sit in the dust, deprived of the former throne that she had been used to experiencing all her life as a nation. Notice the graphic language in verses 2 and 3. Take the millstones and grind meal, remove your veil, strip off the skirt, uncover the leg, cross the rivers. Your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame also will be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Now, I referenced Exodus 11, verse 5, to show you that millstones, grinding meal over a millstone, which is how they ground grain during the old days, was considered the most menial, lowest form of slavery that there was. So you're taking Babylon, who's just so used to luxury and reducing her down to the most pitiful position she could ever have. The veil and the long gown were typically characteristic of the upper class who viewed their beauty as too precious for the commoner to see. But what we see here is there's not going to be anything special about her anymore. And in fact, such finery as they were used to was going to get in the way of her performing her slave work or escaping on foot, whichever position she happened to be in. Babylon thought that they were better than everyone else. They thought that. They acted that way. But God is going to take all that pride and he's going to expose their shame so that they're going to be seen for who they truly are. And when you would have looked at Babylon of antiquity, I mean, just this phenomenal city at that time. There had never been a city so great as this one. Who could possibly take that magnificent city and reduce it down to a position such as this? God. Verse 4, our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. And for whose sake is he doing this? He's doing this for Israel's sake. He's the Holy One of Israel. Being their next of kin, he's going to redeem them. Okay, verse 5, he tells them, sit silently and go into the darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you will no longer be called the queen of kingdoms. See how she was looked at compared to all the other nations of the world? They once dictated the rules, and now Babylon is going to sit in the silence of despair without freedom or position. She was the center of attention in the world at that time. That's why she's called a queen. Not anymore. Verse 6, I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. I gave them into your hand. You did not show mercy to them. On the aged, you made your yoke very heavy. Does that sound like language that was used toward another nation that God had used to punish Israel? What other nation did God say this about? Well, not Egypt. Well, he probably did, but I was thinking of another nation. You've got to read my mind. Come on, guys. Assyria is what I was thinking of. It's probably true of Egypt, too. But remember, Assyria was the rod of God's anger from Isaiah chapter 10. He used Assyria to punish his people, and yet Assyria went too far in some of their cruelty. That's the idea of what Babylon here is doing. The view in the ancient world was that the deity of the nation protected them, and that caused Babylon to think that they were stronger than Jehovah. But just like with Assyria, Babylon was simply a tool in God's hand. And because they had no regard for who was behind their victories, that's what in some ways caused them to disregard human decency toward their captives, just as Assyria had. And it was so bad that they acted this way, as you see, even towards the aged, even towards the elderly. And we know from Scripture that God had a particular proclivity towards those who were aged and elderly. And so this would have definitely pulled on his heartstrings. But while they were unnecessarily cruel, as we see here from verse 6, probably the greater sin was in thinking that no one would ever hold them into account for such behavior. And my, how wrong they were. Verse 7, yet you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider, nor remember the outcome of them. So what are we seeing in Babylon here? We're seeing a nation that was proud, cruel, and extremely presumptuous. They assumed that their dominance would be unending, and so they paid absolutely zero attention to the consequences of their actions. That's always the blind spot of the prideful, isn't it? Never assuming that they're going to reap what they sow. They didn't take a thoughtful view of their conduct, and so that caused them, despite being the center of attention, it caused them to be self-deluded. So any thoughts on any of that before we keep going?
Like our country needs a little bit of hearing that.
Probably.
Taking yeah. For granted that we've done for so many decades.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's no wonder that the name Babylon is used figuratively in the book of Revelation, right? Yeah, think about how many nations since this time has followed in their path, including our own, unfortunately. Yeah. Any other thoughts? All right, let's keep going. Verse 8 and 9. Now then, hear this, you sensual one who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. Does that sound familiar? I will not sit as a widow, nor know loss of children, but these two things will come on you suddenly in one day. Loss of children and widowhood. They will come on you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. Who is the one who has been said about over and over again in Isaiah, I am and there is no one besides me? It's been said about God, right? And who's now saying this about themselves? There at Babylon is saying this about themselves. Remember all the way back in chapter 14 where it talked about how they were going to climb to the heavens itself and sit on God's throne. I mean, this was their attitude. They thought they were equal to deity. They were just that prideful. In fact, the ancient historian Herodotus, who I've alluded to a few times, actually claims that as the Persian army approached, the people of Babylon laughed at them from the walls because they thought it's impossible. You might as well just go home. They were so sure that they were going to be safe in their city. But by thinking this way, they obviously are on a collision course with God. She thinks she's never going to be alone. By the idea that she's always going to have children, never know loss of children, is that she's just going to keep going and going and going. There's always going to be more of them. There's never going to come an end to her heritage. She was so wrong because in terrifying suddenness, Babylon would lose both present and future security. And this is going to happen in spite of her many sorceries, as you see there in verse 9. And Babylon was proverbial in the ancient world for its magical arts. The word Chaldean actually would become synonymous with the idea of being a magician during that time. And many people don't know this, though I bet a few of us do, but guess where all of our astrological constellations find their origin? It's from Babylonians. It's from the Babylonians. That's how deeply immersed even our society is in some of their ways. All those names. What are you? A Taurus? I'm a Taurus. You know where that came from? It came from Babylon. All that traces its way back. All right. Anybody ever used to read in those, what was it? It wasn't National Enquirer. It was some other magazines. It always had like the vampire boy. You know, the vampire boy was always on the front. Remember that? But anyway, I didn't care about the vampire kid, but I always would go to the back because it would tell me like what my next month would be like because I was a Taurus born in this year or something like that. That's the kind of stuff that they used to do back then. That's how they would, their religion was. They could tell the future by looking at the ways that the stars and the other objects of space align themselves and things of that nature. That's where it all originates from, is Babylon. So, I had a whole slide on this from some of my studies of this, but we just don't have time to go through it, unfortunately. So. Let's keep going. Verse 10 and 11. You felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you. For you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. But evil will come on you, which you will not know how to charm away, and disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction about which you do not know will come on you suddenly. In other words, I answer to no one. That's what Babylon thought. They didn't believe in a divine moral arbitrator other than themselves. Ethics had no religious significance to them because her self-deification made her accountable to no one, and her pride and her arrogance led to self-deception. But for all their supposed wisdom and knowledge, verse 11 stresses how much they actually didn't know, as everything that's going to happen to them when God sends Cyrus is going to be completely unprecedented. Since they embraced evil, evil is what they will get, and there is no magic that can stop it. No price that could be paid to atone for their sins and to avoid the disaster that God had planned, because God resists the proud, right? And they were the epitome of that. Any thoughts on any of this before we look at the last few verses? Yeah, Bruce.
Ryan, a few times here he's talked about will come on you suddenly. I'm assuming this suddenly is in reference to later when Daniel interpreted the writing on the wall and mm-hmm. said part of that was this night.
Yeah.
Your kingdom will be taken from you. So that mm-hmm. suddenly is in reference to that very night.
Yeah, probably when the Medes rerouted the Euphrates and in the middle of the night went underneath the walls of from the moat that had dropped significantly and killed all Babylonian royalty in the middle of the night. Yeah, and I think I mentioned this on Wednesday that most people in the city didn't even know that the Persian Empire had taken over Babylon for like 2 or 3 weeks because that did not happen suddenly, but them killing royalty absolutely did, yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts? All right, let's look at these last four verses. These are really cool verses here. What God is going to do here is he's going to challenge their entire religious system to stop what's coming. And if you have time and are just looking for something to study that's kind of interesting, I definitely would encourage you to go and study what Babylon's religion used to be, the constellations, the astrology and all that, and compare it to what some people do in our time. It's really fascinating stuff to see how much our society still clings to the same things that Babylon's religion did. But look in verse 12 and 13. Look at the challenge here that God gives them. Stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you'll be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moon, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. So God had already said in verse 11 that they're not going to be able to charm all this away. But it's funny how he's like welcoming them to try, right? Almost sarcastic. He's like, go ahead, see what you can do. Surely, I mean, sorcerers who had devoted so much time and energy to learning the magical arts because of their beliefs and its power, I mean, surely they'd be able to stop what's coming, right? Well, I think we'd all admit that commitment and discipline to a religion is commendable, but when that religion is false, it only brings weariness, right? Their astrologers, again, did the same thing that we do today in astrology. They divided the heavens into segments, and they studied the movements of the stars and the planets to try to predict earthly events. And if their astrologers had any skill whatsoever to help their devotees to avoid what God was about to bring to them, God's saying, now's the time to put that skill into effect. But they're not going to be able to. And so look at what happens in verse 14 and 15. Behold, they have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, nor a fire to sit before. So have those become to you with whom you have labored, who have trafficked with you from your youth. Each has wandered in his own way. There is none to save you. He compares their magical arts to stubble, completely worthless, easy to burn. And when the fire does come, which I would take to mean the fire of judgment, they're not going to be able to deliver themselves, let alone their devotees. And so the fire is going to do what fire always does. It's going to reveal their true nature, admired in the eyes of their followers, but nothing in the hands of God. This fire that's coming is not going to be some kind kind of warm campfire to sit by. It's going to devour everyone in its path. It's going to be, and they're going to be fuel for it. Nothing beneficial will be left to them. It's not going to be the coal that we saw that cleansed the mouth of Isaiah in Isaiah 6, verse 6. This is going to be an all-consuming blaze. Now, did you notice in the last part, verse 15, how like Tyre, Babylon had actually become somewhat of a center of trade? And what was the trade going on here? It was these false prophets who made a trade out of Babylon. And think about that, because when the market in Babylon finally bottoms out and when it's time to balance the books to see what profit all that false religion brought, what's left? Utter bankruptcy. And what are their former traders going to do at that point? Are they going to stand up and take it like a man? No, they're going to make a quick exit to attempt to avoid danger. That's what Jesus was saying in John 10, verse 12. He who's a hired hand and not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. That's what all these false prophets in Babylon did when Cyrus came. They didn't stand, and they didn't protect their devotees. They fled as fast as they could, took the idols with them. End result, no one was left to save them. Yet the God of Israel can save them. See the point? And that's chapter 47. Thoughts on any of that? Oh, no, bell's rung. Go ahead. Is it quick? Go ahead. I was just kidding.
And it's been the same, and like through Assyria, through Egypt, the pride that builds up, that comes before the fall. It's just, like all the nations through history. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting here profound at how the same it is.
No
matter what the crutch is, it's always something.
You know, as complicated as humanity is, that being us, we're really not that complicated, are we? Yeah. Yeah, good point.
And then I thought about how many times we've talked about that in this class, and like how Isaiah shows that.
Yep.
How many times it is.
Yep. It's the same thing over and over again. That's why God's got to do something new, try to fix the problem, or it's just going to be like the book of Judges, just an endless cycle. Yep. All right, very good. Chapter 48 for Wednesday, and that's going to finish up this section before we get into the good stuff. Thanks, guys.